You're not supposed to be here. We left you 1,000 years in the past.
No.
Yes.
We have never met before. But Zathras, very pleased to be meeting you.
No, we have met.
No. Oh. No. No, you did not meet Zathras. You met Zathras.
Let's try this again.
As you wish.
Zathras came with us to Babylon 4.
Yes.
Zathras stayed in the past with Valen. Yes. You're Zathras.
Yes.
Therefore, you went into the past.
No, that was not Zathras. That was Zathras. There are 10 of us. All of family Zathras. Each one named Zathras. Slight differences in how you pronounce Zathras. 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 You are seen now.
There are 10 of you?
Yes. Well, 9 now.
And Zathras?
Gone. Zathras warned Zathras, but Zathras never listened to Zathras. Zathras was quiet one in family.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. One long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. This past week marked the 20th anniversary of Babylon 5, and I'm joined by my longtime friend and collaborator, Bobby Polite, to talk about it. Bobby, you and I are the two biggest Babylon 5 fans that I know of, with certain exceptions here and there. And so I thought it would be very appropriate and fitting for the two of us just to get together and reminisce a little bit about this show, about what we loved about it, what disappointed us about it, and kind of the impact that it had on us and on science fiction and entertainment in its 5-year glorious run, and then how it's lived on since then. So
barely lived on since
then.
Yeah,
it's been on life support a few times, but. First off, I usually, of course, ask how people came to something, but you and I were both separately in on Babylon 5 from the very beginning. So tell the listeners sort of what you thought at the very beginning when you first came to it. What impression did it make on you at the beginning, and kind of, you know, what did you think about it?
You know, that's funny. I've been knowing we were going to do this. I've been trying to remember the exact moment when I decided to watch. Mm-hmm. The pilot, you know, the gathering. And I don't recall how I actually learned about Babylon 5. I didn't know who JMS was. I'd never heard of the man in my life. And I think I basically just started seeing advertisements for it going, hey, that's not Star Trek. Somebody's making a science fiction show in space that's not Star Trek.
That's Star Trek.
And on top of that, it's got Tamlin Tamita.
Yeah.
What the heck? I'll watch it. And I can remember sitting down and watching the pilot, and you get this introduction in the pilot. You know, the pilot is not it is a pilot. It's kind of clunky in some places. It's got some weirdness to it. And I watched it and went, that was pretty good. I'll give this a shot. I hope they make a series out of this, because I'd like to see something on television that's different, that's new, that's not you know, some other franchise that's continually going. And there's obviously some love behind this where they're trying to build a story. And this is not just somebody going, hey, we need a science fiction show to pull in people on Friday night, you know.
Yeah.
So let's do all the trite things we can do with science fiction in this thing. And plus, it was the beginning of a lot of you know, these shows that were syndicated. They weren't necessarily controlled by any kind of, you know, CBS, ABC, any of the big corporations, that kind of thing, which eventually made it a lot of fun trying to figure out when the show was on, if it was going to be on.
Right.
Because I can remember going to websites and going, is it still on in the Atlanta area? When is it on in the Atlanta area? What channel's got it? Oh, UPN at like 1 in the morning.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to be up at 1 in the morning watching this thing. And there was always this frantic back and forth. When is it going to be on? Because you never knew if it was going to last.
No. That's my favorite story about trying to see it, is by the fourth season, when everything was hitting the fan, you know, the big finale of the Shadow War, it was coming on at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on some local Atlanta channel. And so I was recording it on VHS, and then I would get up to go teach my classes in the Atlanta area, and I would grab that videotape and take it with me in my bag, and there was like a 45-minute break where the students, because I was teaching college classes at local high schools in Rockdale County, and there'd be a 45-minute window or so where they'd be at lunch, and I would get in that classroom while they were at lunch, and I'd get the big TV VCR rolling stand, you know,
yeah,
and I'd have Babylon 5, the latest episode, playing, and I would just be, you know, totally focused on it. And they would all come in from lunch and be like, oh, Plexico's watching that show again.
Well, I remember people would figure out when the satellite downloads were going to be,
mm-hmm,
and intercept the satellite downloads, so they'd get the episode with the big blue spaces in it where the commercials are supposed to fit in.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it was just interesting. That, I think, to be honest, that was one of the reasons that it developed the kind of fan base it had, is because you had to hunt to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made you even more passionate about trying to get it. You
Absolutely.
Wanted this little thing that was different than what you'd seen before to survive.
Yeah.
And so you'd be going, hey, you like science fiction. You need to start watching this show.
We were so evangelical for it, you know. I mean, we were pushing it on everybody all back then. I mean, you're right. I mean, we had to work for it, and that made you appreciate it more. But it was worth it, because if it had been terrible, we wouldn't have, or even mediocre, we wouldn't have worked for it, you know. So
right.
It was just a perfect little combination. I was just thinking about when you said how we started out viewing the first episode, the pilot, The Gathering. I can remember because I don't even remember either. I remember watching it, and I remember watching it with a friend at the time. And I must have seen a couple of commercials that was coming on. But, yeah, it must have made enough impression, the commercials, that I tuned in. Went out of my way to watch it. And I remember that. I remember thinking, oh, there's this new space-based science fiction thing. I probably need to watch that. And I remember, like, the first half of the pilot movie, thinking nothing but comparisons to Star Trek. And I'm ashamed to say that now. But, you know, on February 22nd, 1993, that's how your brain worked if you were a science fiction fan watching TV.
Right.
And so I remember the first half of it thinking, oh, what's up with these uniforms? Oh, they're little communicators on their hands. That's kind of dopey. And then by the second hour, I remember thinking, like, exactly what you said. There's a story here. There's stuff going on. There's this big history. There's this backstory. They totally had me hooked. I meant 1990. Yeah, it was 93, wasn't it? Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
it was 93. Right. I remember thinking, there's a backstory, there's a history, there's a depth to this. Stuff has happened. You know, it's not just we created a Starfleet, now let's go have an adventure. It's there's been war. You know, there's a Psi-Cor. There's a, I don't know if we saw that in the first episode, but yeah, we did. Yeah. With Lita.
Oh. With Lita, right.
Yeah. There's all these things, you know, these institutions, and there's this backstory that Star Trek never really gave you, or at least not up front, you know. You kind of had to piece things together over time with Star Trek, you know, like, well, so.
The funny thing was, is looking back on it, we didn't know what we were in for.
No.
We had no idea. We figured it was going to be like Star Trek. It was going to be these episodic things, and there wouldn't be a whole lot of carryover between them. And, I watched the whole series, then I watched a little bit of Crusade, and then I never really watched it again for, what, almost 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
I let it rest. And then I had some friends who were living with me, and they had never seen B5.
Hmm.
And one of them had watched the first few episodes, but found the acting not to be that interesting, had a hard time getting into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I convinced them to sit down and watch it. And we rewatched the whole series from the beginning to the end. We watched about two episodes a night, four nights a week. And one of the things that really surprised me is how early in the series the foundation starts getting set for the overarching story.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really early, like first episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, I didn't remember it starting that soon. And I'm getting giddy because I know where some of this stuff is going.
Exactly.
And I'm like excited to see this thing again for the next time. And I was also worried about it. I was worried about watching B5 again because I was afraid, well, what if it doesn't hold up? Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that I used to like that I go back and watch them again, and they just really don't hold up. They're not as good anymore, and that ruins my memory. That's probably the reason I didn't watch it for a long time.
Right.
My friends really liked it. They really enjoyed it. They enjoyed a lot of the characters. They got into a lot of the character development. They liked the developing relationships between all these characters, and I watched it going, oh my God, it's as good as I remember it. I'm so happy.
Yeah, I watched it when it first aired on P10, and then TNT had the fifth season, and then I believe it re-aired fairly soon after on the Sci-Fi Channel, and I recorded it when it did that. And I watched it as it aired on the Sci-Fi Channel, and then I watched the recording. So I saw the entire series through three times within the first two or three or four years. And I haven't watched more than an episode here or there ever since. So I've been doing like you did and waiting because I saw it so, you know, we were doing stuff like we were doing the Babylon 5 live action role play at Dragon Con back then. I was very immersed in it, in other words. And so I was so heavily immersed in this show while it was on and for the two or three years after it was on that I needed to just kind of get away from it. It was my number one obsession from about 1990, probably by the second season, from 95 through about 2001. And so I needed to get away from it. So I've let it sit for about 12 years now, and I'm going to go back, I think, and watch it again now that the 20th anniversary's rolled around. But it was an amazing show. I mean, it was different than anything that ever... Now, there's other shows that do things like it now.
Now,
but,
yes.
But at the time, it was very unique. It did the stuff like Lost has done, like Battlestar Galactica has done, but it did it all 10 years, 15 years before they did it, didn't it?
I'm sorry, the Skype lost it for a minute.
Oh, okay. It did so many things that shows now try to do, but it was the first to do it.
Right. It was one of the first really strong... from the beginning, moves away from episodic shows that have loose ties between character development to you're going to start watching this show and you're going to peg all these characters with certain stereotypes, and by the end of the series they're not going to be the same people.
That's right.
Jakar, when I saw Jakar in The Gathering, I went, I don't like that character. He is the typical alien bad guy.
He's the Klingon.
By the end of the series, Jakar is my favorite character that has ever existed.
Yes.
Warrior
becomes priest. Priest becomes warrior. No one here is exactly what he appears to be.
Yes.
Oh, man.
And the funny thing is you can see that in him from the beginning, though, when he's talking to Catherine Sakai,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling her about the walkers at Sigma 957. What was that? You know, he's got that existential philosophy in him, and he can bring it out, but he's so full of hatred for the Centauri
yeah.
that he keeps turning into this villain. that you don't like when he's like that.
Yeah, so. It takes the bigger events of the war to kind of put him in a position to realize the sacrifices that he and his people have to make. And it's really heartbreaking.
Right.
To watch it. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, and Londo, and when you first see him, he's a clown, he's the buffoon, and becomes almost the villain. Who saw that coming in the first couple of episodes?
It's funny because you like him.
Yeah.
You like him. You know he's that likable dirtbag. You know? He's that guy you wouldn't really trust, but he's charismatic, so you like him. And then when you see him getting caught up, he starts getting that taste of power, and he gets caught up in this. And then he gets to the point where he realizes that he sold his soul and he can't figure out how to get it back.
Seeing a character that you care about so trapped and with no way out is another really sort of heartbreaking, tough thing just to kind of endure as a viewer. It's so, yeah, I mean, so much of the show is so painful to watch. And I don't mean painful in a bad way. I mean painful in a good drama way, you know, that you just, it breaks your heart, you know.
Well, you get to where you care about the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not just the major characters. I mean, you know, I like Zach.
Yeah.
I every time Zach would appear on the screen and you know, he's sitting there and he's pining for Lita and you're like, would you just go talk to her? You just come on.
And the one time that he does.
Right. He picks the exact wrong moment to do it. He waits just too long.
In third space. So. She's all hypnotized. And the mysteries that the show swirled about us, things like the shadows and the Vorlons. You know, it was interesting because we had the Vorlons right in front of us the whole time and never quite put two and two together until, I guess, the third season. And the shadows, on the other hand, it's kind of interesting because they were both the key components of the mystery, but one is right out in plain sight and the other one is hidden. And you spend so much time trying to figure out the one that's hidden that you don't completely appreciate what's going on with the one in plain sight, you know?
Right.
And,
right.
And it was because I would argue that the Vorlons ended up being at least as much of the villains of the show as the shadows.
They definitely were. They definitely were. Except for the one.
Except for yeah.
You had the one Vorlon who had apparently been in and among the lesser races for too long, and so he had compassion for them, whereas the other Vorlons did not seem to.
Right. Yeah. They were lords of order.
Right.
You know, a couple of things about the show and how it was made, which make it even more miraculous that it happened. It was the whole thing was filmed in a hot tub factory in Los Angeles. That just continues to make me laugh. If they had got an old warehouse factory building off the interstate, and you know, the only way you would have known that it was they were filming a science fiction show there instead of making hot tubs was if you drove up and there was a Narn sitting there smoking cigarettes in front of the front door
or a cigar.
Yeah, exactly. Because they made it under budget and on time. I mean, Straczynski had done other shows and he was determined to bring this show in on time under budget. And he did. They cut corners everywhere they could. The special effects were, this was the first show to extensively use CGI, wasn't it?
Right. To the degree that they did. Yes, it was, as far as I know, it was the first show.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because you can see As the series goes on, you can see as they get more powerful computers and more computers to render. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you first start out, the Star Furies are cool, but they're a little clunky the way they move. And then by the time you get to like Severed Dreams,
yeah,
you know, they're just flying all over the place doing these quick turns, and you know, it's you can just see the improvement in the special effects as the series goes on. And that was one of the other things that one of the other things that pulled me into the series is it wasn't magical spaceships flying around like you know, three-dimensional Navy going ships or like you know, giant aircraft carriers in space. It was, you know, hey, we have to obey the laws of physics here. To a degree, mm-hmm. You know, we have to bleed off our thrust. We turn in such a way. The Star Furies were one of the things that really appealed to the hard science in me. I watched them and I went, that's a cool fighter.
Well, then
it's not these airplanes turned into X-Wings things out of Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, the NASA people loved that about it too. I mean, they liked it. So it was a big favorite, you know, among the astronaut types and all that. So I every time I look at Babylon 5 now, I think what it could have looked like, because they did such a great job with what they had. I mean, you know, you got to make an emperor's palace on a tiny budget. You just hang gauzy, you know, sheets of cloth everywhere, and there you go.
Right. And put a little gold stuff around, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, it's almost like a soap opera how they'll just make the set look as close to what they need to as they can. But imagine if they'd had the Star Trek money resources, you know, or even Battlestar Galactica, what the show would have looked like. It just makes you think, God, good grief.
But is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because if you start spending too much money on the sets and things, that could become your primary focus. I've seen lots of movies that had lots of money that were crap.
Well, that's true. Well, if you adjust for quality, in other words, we say we know the quality will stay the same, but think how it could have looked if it had a little more resource, just because it would have pulled more viewers in, I think. I mean, that was always one of the handicaps for the show, was that it never got the popularity that it deserved, in part because there were people that were not willing to look past the superficialities.
Well, there are lots of people who don't look at it too and go, it's not Star Trek, it's not Star Wars, I'm not interested.
My favorite story, there's so many convention stories, you know, from this show. I've met most of the cast, and including Straczynski and everything at conventions, and I've heard all these stories. And I think my favorite one along the lines you just mentioned is when Straczynski said that when the first few episodes had aired, and a woman came up to him at a convention and said, you know, I want to like your show, but it's just so implausible that I can't watch it. And he says, well, what about it? You know, what about it is implausible? You know, and she said, well, it's been already firmly established that in the future, personal communicators will be worn as lapel pins and not on your hand.
Really? Really?
Yes.
Is that a real story?
I did not make that up.
Wow.
Maybe JMS made it up, but he told that story.
Right.
So I've heard a million stories like that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff the fans would say to them, and it just drove them crazy, the cast, the crew.
Well, you know, you're talking about the quality of the sets and things like that. In some ways, that makes it more similar to the original Star Trek, where they would throw together sets. You know, it's obvious that they didn't have a lot to work with to make the sets in the original Star Trek. They had the drapes hanging over things kind of look sometimes.
Now, that was one of my favorite jokes about the old Star Trek, was somebody said, oh, look, on this episode of Star Trek, the budget was running low, so they're exploring a planet that looks like Greg Brady's bedroom.
Right.
So, you know, since we're talking about just generalities here about the show and everything, I loved how the opening credits changed every season. It seems like most shows try really hard to keep the same consistent look to keep pulling viewers back, but I think in the long run it makes people kind of tired of it. But Babylon 5 is the first and the only show I can think of that changed the entire opening credits sequence every year.
Well, the opening credits set the tone for the series, the season that was coming on, and some of them were the opening credits were teasers season 3? Season 3, you're sitting there looking at it, and it goes, oh, it's a Star Fury shooting at another Star Fury. What?
Yeah, and it failed, you know, where Susan Ivanova does the voiceover, and she says, the Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace, which is how they'd opened the first, you know, two seasons.
Right.
And then she goes, it failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater, our last best hope for victory. And then you think, wow. And they changed the year. You know, each season of the show was a year of real time.
Right.
And they would mention that at the beginning. And then I think, for all the bad we can say about season 5, the opening credits of season 5 are worth watching just by themselves as like a greatest hits of the series, you know. And they break it down by year.
Yeah.
So I just love that the music, the opening credit, the, you know, the 2258, 2259, 2260, 2261.
You know, my friends actually like season 5 better than season 4.
That's just crazy talk.
Well, but you know, I can understand why.
I've never heard anybody else say that, so tell me.
When we were watching season 4, mm-hmm. it was constantly under the shadow, will there be a season 5?
Mm-hmm.
And to them, their comments on season four was it felt very rushed.
Well, that's the truth. There's no doubt about that.
It felt very rushed. Things happened very quickly to resolve a bunch of storylines. Mm-hmm. And I think they liked season five because they got back into some more personal stories. And it actually started illuminating to some of the world around Babylon 5 itself. Yeah. I know when a view from the gallery, is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah.
Came out. I can remember you hated that episode. You hated that episode. A lot of people hated that episode. Why do we need to see that episode? I'm like, thank you for that episode. That was great. Because we got to see everything from a different perspective. And that was kind of nice, I thought.
Okay. Well, here's my thought about that, because you're absolutely right. But my opinion changed over time. When it first aired, that's the episode, for those who don't remember, that was the episode where the two janitors, which is kind of funny to think they're sci-fi janitors, because those are the two guys at Dragon Con now, the Bob and Carl, the sci-fi janitors, actually started on Babylon 5. But you had the two sci-fi janitors on Babylon 5, and everything was from their point of view. I didn't like it at the time because I was totally into the arc, the story arc, and I wanted more story arc, more bang episodes. And so a whole episode, it just felt like a wasted week to me. Now, going back and watching it like I did later, the whole thing straight through, when I could just go right ahead to the next episode, then it was fine, because then I could just take it for what it was and then just fast forward to, or, you know, as soon as it was over, zip right on to the next episode.
But that episode reveals things about characters that would have been difficult to reveal in any other way, and I argue that it works with the arc.
Okay. It's been a long time since I've seen it, so I can't tell you.
Yeah, I saw it last year, and that was one of the episodes I was waiting for to come along to watch it again, especially since I was watching the series the way it was. And I liked it. I still liked it a lot.
Well, yeah, so. there are definitely some good standalone episodes in season five. I mean, the one that Neil Gaiman wrote, Day of the Dead, I think is one of the better ones. I love that episode. And you get some flashbacks to some of the characters you haven't seen in a while, which is kind of fun.
Now, what is it? Gray 17 is missing. That's still crap.
Yeah. there's a handful of episodes from across the entire 5 years that you could just toss in the trash. I mean, I think Infection is the one that Straczynski said he wished he could just kind of like lose the master tape, you know, or whatever, drop it in the ocean or something. But
that's the one with the guy becomes the war machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's got some stuff in it that's kind of necessary, though.
Yeah.
Probably would have been better if it just didn't devolve into a giant monster movie.
Yeah, yeah. It turns into Space 1999 second season.
Right.
But which is – usually I would say that in a good way, but here I mean it in a bad way. I think – and for the listeners out there, I think that what we're planning on doing, Bobby and I are going to go back over time, over the next maybe couple, 3-4 months – if we can, and sort of look at the individual seasons, which should be fun. So that's why we're not touching on quite as many specifics this time as we could, but we're going to kind of dig through it in more depth as we go along maybe. But I did want to mention something about the bigger picture, because you were talking about the changes because of the fifth season, you know, that the fourth season was rushed and everything, and not everybody
felt rushed. The claim is not that it wasn't rushed, but it felt rushed.
Oh, it was definitely rushed. He can say whatever he wants to say, but we know the truth. Because here's what happened. I mean,
there's a lot of fill-in episodes in season five, it seems like.
And they would have been spaced out through season four, but instead you get all the action in season four and then all the spaced out episode, you know, the spacing episodes in season five. Well, here's for the listeners that don't know, real quick, here's what happened. And you correct me or add anything you want to, but let me kind of run through how it played out. What happened was, it was on P10, this sort of conglomerate syndicated network of shows, the first four seasons, and that was coming to an end, and so it looked as if the show was going to end at the end of season four. Of course, Straczynski's big plan was for the show to run 5 years, and so he had written all the arcs out, at least in general outlines, to end at the end of season five. So what he had to do, he had set up both the Shadow War and the Earth War with President Clark. And so originally what would have happened would have been that the Shadow War would have taken up most of season four. There had just been more buildup to it. And it wouldn't have been over with in, I think, what, the fourth episode?
Or yeah, it was very quick.
It was either fourth or sixth. It was Into the Fire was the wrap-up.
It was four or six, yeah.
And then You go from that straight into the Earth War, which also wraps up at the end of season four. And originally what would have happened is there's an episode kind of midway through season four where Sheridan is captured and is being held by Clark's forces and being like drugged and interrogated. That was going to be the season four finale. And the cliffhanger would be what happens to Sheridan. He's, you know, he's trapped with the bad guys. That would have been the end of season four, and so you would have gotten the big finish of the Earth War and President Clark like early midway through season five. But instead, they had to squeeze the Shadow War into the first four or five episodes of the season four, and then immediately resolve the Earth War before the end of season four. And then they had also already filmed Sleeping in Light, which was the series finale. So they took the series finale and put it on the shelf for a year and filmed a new season four finale, The Deconstruction of Falling Stars. And that's one that's very popular, by the way.
I was going to say, and the best thing to come out of this, are we going to have a season five thing, was The Deconstruction of Falling Stars. I love that episode. I think that episode's great.
I know a lot of people really love that episode, including me. Yeah, that's the one where they sort of jump ahead years and years and years into the future and look back. And it's a nice little kind of a meta, you know, episode where you sort of see what all becomes of things down the road a little bit. There's you get kind of a post-apocalyptic part. You get a computer simulation part. You get a critique of the media and commentary, right?
Right.
And then you kind of get a little teaser of like a million years from now or something. So that's all where you get the sense that that Earth goes off to be like the Vorlons or something. So
humanity, yeah.
Yeah. So, what that meant was that doing season five, they'd already resolved all the big storylines for the most part from the first four seasons. All they really had left was Psycor. So you get way more Psycor episodes and telepath episodes at the beginning of season five than you normally would have. And you get some sort of standalone episodes that would have been more scattered out through four and five. You kind of get them all clumped together there. And then you get the second half of season five, which I thought was pretty good. Once you get the telepaths out of the way, that was kind of a disappointment to me. But the second half of season five I thought was very good because it was the picking back up on the leftover Shadows tech, the Drock, what happens to Londo.
And Lita,
right. So, yeah, that's right. The Sheridan pointing the gun at Lita's head, that was in the Wheel of Fire. That was a fun moment. But yeah, so that all changed the story pretty dramatically.
Well, having watched all of season five, one right after the other, over a period of about a week and a half. Probably a little longer than a week and a half. The telepath stuff, I remember being very anxious with the telepath stuff, the Byron arc, and not enjoying it that much. It actually was much better on a second viewing because it's really not that many episodes. To me, remembering back, it was like, was that like 12 episodes? It felt like 12 episodes.
Right.
It's really not that many episodes, and it's really more about Lita. Hmm. And it's really interesting watching it again because you realize that Lita is slowly moving towards becoming a tragic figure. Mm. And it's partly because no one will pay attention to her or will treat her like all a little afraid of her because not only is she a telepath, she's a telepath that's been modified by Vorlons. And so they're all kind of pushing her away except for Zach. And he tries to bring her back in, but it just ends up not working,
mm-hmm.
you know, and partly because of Byron, and that starts leading her along this path where she would become kind of a tragic figure, I think, especially if you go through the novels with what happens with her, because her story resolves in the novel.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also fascinating to realize that that would have been Ivanova.
Yes. Yeah.
I just can't imagine Ivanova in that, because she's so strong and independent.
No, she. I don't see Ivanova working in that at all. Well, okay. I can see that you could do that story with Ivanova, but the dynamic between Ivanova and Byron and all that stuff would have been different. We would have had a different feel, I think.
Ivanova's more like a drill sergeant, whereas Lita is vulnerable. I just couldn't imagine Ivanova being all mushy-gooshy. And if she was, the actor that played Byron, I thought he worked for Lita's kind of boyfriend or whatever, but not for Ivanova's. You'd have needed somebody more commanding and charismatic to really, I think, capture her devotion. You know, he just didn't strike me as somebody that Commander Ivanova would have given the time of day.
Yeah.
So, plus you had the whole thing with Marcus. Well, I guess they would have said that the thing with Marcus made her more vulnerable or something. That would have been kind of one.
Well, it would have probably made her more, because see, remember at the end, she's like, you know, I refused to open up and therefore I lost Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing ever happened. So you rebound from that and suddenly the first person, woo, you know,
yeah.
I'm not letting this pass by. So
yeah, right. Well, that makes sense. But I want to mention the other big sort of change that happened in the series that affected the storyline tremendously, and one that hasn't been talked about, I think, in depth very much, is that it was funny to me how at the end of season one, Straczynski set up possible trap doors for basically every major character to leave the show. And to me, the funny thing was the one that he did the least getting ready to get rid of is the one that ended up leaving, which was Sinclair. And of course, that was sort of a network decision in conjunction with JMS. They kind of made a joint decision to find somebody maybe more appealing or more charismatic or more of an action hero or something. And I understand that. I appreciate the character of Jeffrey Sinclair and the late Michael O'Hare's interpretation of him more after the fact. But at the time, I was not a huge Michael O'Hare fan, and I can enjoy it for what it is now. And I thought he was great when he came back on the show in season three. I thought in that role as like a holy man, he was very good. But as the commanding figure, he never seemed completely plausible to me. So Sinclair leaves the show. He goes to Minbar to be the Earth ambassador there, and ends up becoming Ranger One, basically, if I recall correctly, and
yes,
recruiting people like Marcus. And so you bring in Sheridan. Now, of course, that changes the immediate dynamic of the show because Bruce Boxleitner is a very likable, smiling Johnny. he's a more likable, dynamic, charismatic, tough guy of a leading man. And I thought, you know, he just did a spectacular job. But for the story, though, this is what I think is fascinating, is that if you keep Sinclair on there and not bring in Sheridan ever, then Anna Sheridan's character is Catherine Sakai. Correct?
Right.
Catherine's.
And they'd already been kind of setting that up,
exactly.
Foreshadowing that.
Right. She went to Sigma 957, et cetera, et cetera. So basically what would have happened was we'd have come back at the first episode of season two. Sinclair would have married or have already married Sakai, or they would get married, and then she'd go off on her expedition and never come back. So he's right. Just married her and she's gone. And of course, what happens is she finds the shadows, and she gets put into a shadow ship. So that would have been Catherine Sakai, not Anna Sheridan. And then Sinclair would have first won the shadow war. What Sheridan does, Sinclair would have won the shadow war, would have led all the races to victory in 2261. And then he would have gone back in time and won the first Shadow War.
Oh, you think that's the way it would have gone?
I mean, well, I mean,
I've often wondered how they would do the B4 storyline if Sheridan was still there.
Sinclair,
I mean, yeah.
I mean, don't you think? I mean, because they'd been setting up all along that Sinclair was Valen.
That's true. They had been setting that up from the beginning.
So he had to go back. He always went back.
Well, see, I'm glad that they did it the way they did it, though, because yeah, it actually works better, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's what...
It would have been harder to swallow the other way.
Exactly. That's what JMS said was, he said, Sinclair's story is the Minbar Valen story. And he said giving him the shadow story was probably a bit too much for one character.
Yeah.
So you get Sheridan to be the shadow character. In other words, to have the wife who becomes a shadow slave, basically, and to deal with the shadow war. And all of that, and then you have Sinclair to go back and be Valen. But yeah, I think that instead of I think that Sleeping in Light, instead of ending with I think that that's why War Without End 1 and 2 happened when it did. I don't think it originally was supposed to happen there. I think that You wouldn't have even gotten War Without End in season three. And what would have happened was you'd have gotten all the way to Sleeping in Light, and instead of going off to go beyond the rim with
He'd go back.
He'd go back, yeah.
Right.
That would have been the end of the series right there, bang. And that would have been pretty cool.
That would have been neat, but I think it would have been too much for one character.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's funny you were talking about, you know, you didn't like Sinclair as much as you like Sheridan. I think most people feel that way. I like Sinclair a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I liked him a lot watching it the second time. My friends had a lot of trouble, I think, adapting to Sheridan. They really liked Sinclair, and it took a while for Sheridan to grow on them.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, I liked Sheridan from the minute we saw him on the Agamemnon. I just thought, oh, we finally got a leading man here, the commander that's somebody more likable. I mean, because Sinclair was cerebral. He was interesting. I mean, I totally get why you'd cast him, because he was an interesting guy. But see, here's the thing. With Sinclair, with Michael O'Hare's portrayal of Sinclair, when he was pensive, when he was thinking about things, when he was torn, when he was uncertain, I thought he was very interesting. But when he was trying to step up and be the commanding figure, I thought he was not as plausible. He was more a guy of the mind than an action guy, it seemed to me. Whereas Sheridan was kind of able to do both to a certain degree.
Right. I don't know. They're different characters to me, of course. And I don't know. I liked Sinclair because I don't know. It felt like there was a depth to him that I never really saw in Sheridan. Sheridan was all right out there in front of you.
That's true.
So,
well, Sheridan was the guy to turn to, like, the homilies and so forth, right? I mean, he was more emotion. He's like, right. Well, my dad said, you know, don't start a fight, but always end it. He was that kind of guy. Whereas Sinclair would have been like, what should we do here? You know, what would be wise in this situation? You know, he was more considering of things and less just kind of visceral emotion, you know.
Well, ultimately, I'm glad we got both characters, and I'm really glad that Sinclair had the story arc that he did. The Valen story arc, I don't like time travel in shows. It's one of the reasons I really don't later day Star Trek. But the Babylon 4 time travel stuff was fantastic because it wraps itself up, it goes on, and it tells a very interesting story that solves a mystery.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it's funny because they came back. They had done Babylon Squared in season one to kind of just – that episode was nothing but, ooh, here's some stuff for you to think about, you know?
Right.
It wasn't really an entire story by any means, but it was just like, oh, look at this stuff. Think about this. And then they came back, you know, 2 years later, right, toward the end of season three, and they had to recreate the sets, recreate the costumes. Tim Choate had to come back and remember how to do that character of Zathras, who's one of my favorite characters ever, by the way. I love Zathras. And they really did kind of seamlessly, and with the addition of a new character with Sheridan, right? They had to wrap
right.
it, and Marcus. They brought it back around, so very impressive.
Yeah, you know, mentioning Zathras when we've talked about Sinclair and Jakar, it's kind of sad we're never going to have that Babylon 5, the motion picture moment, because this show has lost so many people.
It's unbelievable.
Richard Biggs and, I mean, a lot of the main characters from the TV show are gone.
Well, let's kind of see. Who's the list? We lost, first we lost Richard Biggs and Andreas Katsulas. And then Tim Choate, Zathras.
Jeff Conaway.
And then Jeff Conaway. And then
Michael O'Hare.
Wow. That's at least five right there.
Yeah.
So it is, I mean, I don't think we ever would have gotten the movie like you're saying, but
right.
it's kind of sad to know we can't.
Right. Of course, that's the one thing about Babylon 5, though, to me, and it's probably the reason that I never could quite get into any of the follow-on stuff. Mm. It is a story. It runs to its end, and then it's over with.
Yeah.
It's done. And a lot of times when you start writing new stories in the Save Universe in a place like that, it starts kind of, for me anyway, it can, unless you do it just absolutely perfectly, lessen the original story. And so I've that's one of the reasons I've started shying away from sequels and things of that nature, is because sometimes I like what I've seen so much, it's done. It's enough for me. Let's move on to something new.
Well, I think that the strength of Babylon 5, it had many strengths, but the absolute, if you made a pyramid of all of its strengths, the top piece is that it was this one big, long, epic. It's like, I used to say, it's not a TV series like Star Trek. It's a mini series like Shogun or Roots that just runs for 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years.
Yeah, it's just a really long mini series, and that tells one big story. And so what happens is, when you do it in any other way, in a small way, even a 2-hour movie, it's just not the same. It's, you know, it's like if you it's like if what you love is a 10-volume novel series, then reading a short story is nice, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Crusade had the potential, in my view, to be something different and almost equally epic, but it wasn't allowed to do that. We'll talk about it in a future episode, because I dearly love Crusade, and I've been heartbroken for 14 years now about that stinking show. But everything else that they try to do, Legend of the Rangers, the Untold Tales DVD, all that other stuff, the little short stories that he published, all that other stuff failed for me, mostly because it could not be a 5-year gigantic epic. And that's just the nature of it. It couldn't be that.
Yeah.
So
it was just filling around the edges.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's nice. It has its place. It's nice to read a little story about what happens to Ivanova or what happens to Lita or something, but it's not the same. And so, and the little Untold Tales are just little short stories. They're nice little bits with those characters, but it's not the same as getting 5 years of Crusade. So, you know.
Right.
So I don't know what JMS is doing now, if we'll ever get anything else like this from him. He's basically said this is the thing that, you know, will be on his tombstone, be his epitaph, that he, you know, he was the daddy of Babylon 5, and that's certainly well deserved. He's gone on to do comics, and he directed Ron Howard directed the movie he wrote, the what's it called? With Angelina Jolie, got an Oscar nomination. You know what I'm talking about?
That wasn't Ron Howard. That was Clint Eastwood, The Changeling.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I was wondering if that was what you were talking about.
Yeah. So he's done some other things, including at least one fairly prestigious thing, but he hasn't shown much inclination to go back and revisit Babylon 5. We did get the series of paperbacks, and we can talk about those later on too. But we got two series of paperbacks, actually, the Del ones and then the Del Rey. But I asked him, I saw him at Heroes Con in Charlotte a few years ago, and it's the first and only time I'd ever met him. And I waited in line 2 hours one day to ask him this question, and then he never showed up because they gave him, it wasn't his fault, but he didn't show up. They told him the wrong time or something. So the next day I waited in line 2 more hours, and I was like the last person to get to see him, and he was packing up. But he was very gracious to stay the whole time, see everybody. And I said to him, after the preliminaries, I said, I love Crusade, and I'm just wondering if we're ever going to get the rest of that story. And he kind of frowned and looked around uncomfortably a little bit, and he says, well, that was done for a TV show, and the TV show's gone. And so, you know, and I said, you're not going to do novels or comic book or get Peter David to write it or something. And he goes, well, it was done for a TV show and, you know, it's kind of done. And I said, so we're never going to get to find out what happens to Gideon or Galen or Matheson. And he kind of hemmed and hawed around and it was like very negative. And I came away from that very bummed, because, you know, if you love Babylon 5, you got that whole story, even though he had to kind of fudge it in a few places to make it work over 5 years. But for Crusade, you know, we may never know what was going to happen with all of that. And that's,
yeah,
that just is very sad to me. So, but I guess you can't have everything.
Yeah. And well, think about it. Think about how much effort he put into Babylon 5. I mean, he's got the Guinness Book World Record thing for most consecutive TV shows written by one author or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of work.
He wrote, the second half of season two, all of three, all of four, and five all the way up until the Neil Gaiman episode?
The Neil Gaiman episode, yeah.
So, good heavens.
So that's a lot of work.
And
somebody might not want to commit to that again.
Oh, I understand that. Well, he did, though. He made the choice. It wasn't his choice to kill Crusade, so it was TNT. Damn them to hell for all of eternity. So,
but they know drama.
They know
anyway,
wrestling.
Sorry.
I lost a train of thought with that one. Oh yeah, that's one of the things about season one, though, in particular, that sometimes puts people off is that a number of season one episodes, even though JMS kind of did a rewrite on some of the scripts to make them fit the larger story arc, I think Larry DiTillo and a couple of other, maybe DC Fontana got one in there, and
she got a couple, I think.
Yeah, so there's, and they're not bad writers by any means, but one of the strengths of Babylon 5 is that single unified voice that you get from Straczynski writing the vast, you know, balance of the series. And so, you know, there are some episodes, particularly in season one, that kind of feel different. They don't quite feel like the rest of the series. The boxing one for particular to me was kind of a low point. TKO.
Yeah. TKO.
Yeah. Anything that DiTillo did always gave it kind of a quirky sci-fi flavor. Like, he came up with the Jovian sunspot, which makes no sense and just doesn't seem like something Straczynski ever would have done. The vicar, the guy that was a robot with a robot head or whatever, that was a DiTillo thing. That just didn't seem like anything Straczynski would have given us. It just wasn't serious.
But that did come into play, though. Or it was going to come into play, because that was going to be... you always got the feeling that was a way to save Talia.
Yeah, right. And then we lose her, and it doesn't matter. So, well, let's see. As we kind of move toward our conclusion, what were some of your favorite moments or things in general about the series that you look back now fondly?
Oh, good grief!
You'll probably have more time for this than me, because you just saw it.
Wow. Well, all of Severed Dreams.
Oh yeah,
I think that whole line that DeLynn has, you know, and I can only paraphrase it. The only Earth Alliance captain to destroy a Minbari ship is behind me. You were in front of me. Be somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, that whole scene is just that whole episode is great.
That episode is
you just don't even see it coming either. It's like, wow, the series just went this way.
Yeah,
suddenly.
it's the dead center of the series too. It's right in the middle of season three. And it's, I always say, it's where it goes from kind of Star Trek to being something completely never seen before on television.
Yeah, I mean, it was the series was very brave about changing directions and changing the characters.
Yeah.
So, there are places where there's a few places where that's kind of sad. Like, you know, I really liked Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to Marcus is, well, obvious. He was looking for someone to sacrifice himself for all the way through the series.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sad to see him go, because he was such a refreshing character.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's little mini stories like that, like with why have I forgotten the character's name? The warrior cast.
Oh, yeah. DeLynn's sort of adversary that ends up...
Wow, why have I forgotten his name? He's like one of my favorite characters, but he's got that little mini arc where he, you know, his character changes, and it's very important to the show.
Mm-hmm.
That he comes to the revelation that he comes to.
Yeah.
And he's been this thorn in everybody's side since he first appeared, which I think was in the first season, wasn't it?
I think maybe, in that there was at least one episode where the Minbari are on the station kind of throwing their weight around a little bit. So,
right.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's too many things, and none of them are coming to my head.
Well,
right
you know,
now.
The thing that's interesting about Severed Dreams too, and what came after it, was this seems like nothing now, but at the time, the continuity that they showed visibly after that, for example, like you said, DeLynn and the Minbari ships show up at the end of Severed Dreams. Well, if this had been any show prior to Babylon 5, you wouldn't have seen those Minbari ships again unless they were needed for a story point. No, with Babylon 5, every exterior shot of the station that you get after Severed Dreams has those Minbari ships orbiting the station, protecting it.
Well, and then and later on, when the you know League of Non-Aligned Worlds becomes involved, you see Varee ships, and you see all kinds of other racial ships out there that are patrolling that space, protecting the station.
Right. Well, and by that time, I was like, oh, I get it. That's what they're going to do. But that first episode after Severed Dreams, where you still see those ships there, it seems like such a little thing now, but it was such a signal that they're actually paying attention. They're actually keeping the continuity going, that if something happened in 311, well, then in 312, you still see that.
Right.
And it really struck me very profoundly that was the case.
Oh, Bester. There you go. I forgot Bester. Bester's one of the best things in the series. Walter Koenig?
Yeah, Koenig.
Right? Yeah, he just makes an absolutely wonderful villain. And then later on, you get these moments where it's like, wow, why do I feel sympathy for Bester in this scene? I don't want to sympathize with him. I hate him.
But he's so entertaining and fun and everything. Yeah. Sheridan has that great line where Bester says he could do something, and Sheridan says, you could do that, and I could nail your head to the table, set it on fire, and feed the charred remains the Pachmara. They have great interplays between the two of them. Yeah. That was fantastic. Let's see, Bester did show up in season one, didn't he? So he actually has to interplay with Sinclair a little bit.
Yeah, it was the it wasn't Mind War, it was he showed up in the first episode he's in is the one with Ironheart.
Yeah, that's Mind War.
Oh, is that it's Mind War. Yeah.
So that's pretty early on. So wow, okay. Yeah, so he was on the show pretty much the whole run. And yes. and his story isn't really resolved until the Psycor trilogy, which Greg Keyes wrote, and then he actually was going to turn up in Crusade some. There's an unproduced script for Crusade that had him in it.
That would have been great. He's like one of the better villains that you don't ever want him actually to see him defeated or killed, because you want that little menace out there running around.
He was a little menace.
Well, and the thing is that when you start to get to know him a little bit more, he really believes in what he's doing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so did probably a lot of Nazis, but.
And that's basically what JMS makes the Psycor, a bunch of Nazis. But yeah, I guess my favorite things. I really liked Talia Winters, and I hated her having to leave the show. Though they certainly gave her it's funny because the I think her character arc would have been Nakamura, right? Wasn't that her name? The Talia Tamilin Tamita. What was her name? Tamlin Tamita was the she was the second in command before Ivanova, and she definitely had connections to the Psycor and to the bad guys. You could tell they were going to set her up to be what Talia, I think, later became, which is the person who betrays the
Well, I think she was supposed to be the person who ends up shooting Garibaldi, right?
Yeah, that would have been even more. Jack.
I can't remember her name now. Anyway,
but she was Tamlin Tamita, but I don't remember the character. But yeah, she would have. And I guess that would have been one of the cliffhangers at the end of season one, is that she both, you get sort of that divided loyalties episode, and you get what happens in Chrysalis. So. Yeah, the show, it's interesting to consider how the story would have been different with the different actors, you know, staying or going or whatever.
Right.
I thought that the entire resolution of the Shadow War was fantastic. I know that a lot of people criticized it, didn't think it was action enough or whatever, but I thought it made perfect sense and fit with what had been set up to that point. And so the beginning of the end of season three, beginning of season four, I think is just one of the high points in television history. My jaw was on the floor for every bit of that. You know, from the moment that Sheridan goes to Zaha Doom all the way until the get the hell out of our galaxy. that whole bit is just, that is right in my wheelhouse. The big military cosmic stuff.
I enjoyed that, but I actually enjoyed the resolution or somewhat lack of resolution of all the Centauri politics that were going on with the Emperor.
Yeah.
And, you know, Morden on the planet and all that sort of stuff. That by the way, and I don't want to spoil this, the Vir Morden foreshadowing is probably about one of the best things in the whole series.
And so, you know, and that's another thing about season five that's kind of sad for me, is that so many of the good characters are no longer on the show by season five, that they really don't, he doesn't have his full complement of tools to work with. I mean, you know, you don't have Talia, you don't really have Morden around anymore, you don't have the Vorlons, the Shadows, and Kosh around anymore.
There's but just, Morden shows up in season five.
Well, I know he does, but I said sort of, but he is kind of limited in what he, you know, JMS was kind of limited in what he had to work with on an episode to episode basis in season five. So,
well, and he had to introduce a whole new commander of the station.
Yeah, that's right.
In season five, and I think she did a great job. She just didn't have enough time to. She was looking when I watched it again, Lockley.
Hold on, we just lost you a second. You said that they introduced the new commander in season five and go from there.
I mean, they introduced the, you know, Elizabeth Lockley in season five. And so they had to not only pick up a story, some sort of storyline, they had to start getting everyone used to Lockley.
Mm-hmm.
And she just didn't have enough time to become a hugely memorable character. She's not really in as much of season five as I had thought she was when I rewatched it.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, it's
kind of a shame. I liked her. I liked her a lot.
It's interesting because she would have been a fairly mid-range character on Crusade. We would have seen more of her. She was in a couple of episodes and they went to Babylon 5 at least twice. And that's in the 13 episodes of that series. So we would have gotten more of her if that show had continued. And I think she was an interesting character.
I can't remember. I know there was definitely a relationship between her and Gary Cole's character. Weren't they married at one point? Was that what?
No, what it was that
Jared was married too. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Gideon meets her and they're kind of having a kind of halfway romantic thing. And he says something about the person I admire most, my hero, John Sheridan. And she says something along the lines of like, oh, my ex-husband. And he's like, what?
Yeah.
Something along those lines. Yeah, John Sheridan. So. Because that was the great thing that was revealed to Straczynski that he didn't even realize, allegedly. This is another one of those quick convention stories that, you know, that somebody stood up at a convention and said to him, I wasn't at this when I heard this secondhand, that somebody said to him, you know, I like how everything is on Babylon 5, it happens in threes. And JMS is like, yeah, I was trying to do that, you know. And they said, especially Sheridan's wives. And he's like, well, what do you mean? And the person says, well, you know, he first had the military caste wife, Lockley, and then he had the worker caste wife, Anna, and then he had the religious caste wife, Delenn. And JMS kind of blinked and said, dang, I'm smarter than I thought.
Wow, I didn't even know. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah,
everybody forgets Lockley was his wife, though, because that's just like a shocking aside.
Yeah.
In you know, this thing that just kind of surprised you in one of the episodes. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, later on. So,
and we've just spoiled it for everybody.
Watched the show. I'm thinking if the show's been around for 20 years as of Friday, so if you haven't watched it by now, hearing our reminiscence is probably not the best place for you to start. You should watch the show and then listen to us about how great it was. All right. Well, I guess we're close to the end of our time here. Any last thoughts? And like I said, I am looking forward to kind of going back in more detail in the future and kind of going maybe season by season. We can dig around into some of the good stuff in more detail. So we are not done with it yet. But any last general thoughts before we wrap up in celebration of the anniversary?
If you haven't seen it, give it a try.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty easy to come across. Now, the DVDs kind of stink because Warner Brothers really did a bad job on putting them together. So there's lots of scenes, especially when they composite the special effects, that are blurry and they don't need to be. And I wish Warner Brothers would get off their butts and come out with, you know, updated Blu-rays or DVDs that have a better quality. But
they definitely need to do that.
That's not going to ever happen.
There's no excuse. They should need it. They need to put that out on Blu-ray like yesterday.
Well, it seems to me they've taken B5 and just put it in a closet and said, we're not ever going to look at this again.
I mean, because it was filmed, right? It's on film. It was filmed in in widescreen. It was
They wanted it filmed that way because they knew that widescreen
HD
TVs were coming up.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that they didn't do the special effects in widescreen, if I remember what I was reading.
Yeah.
And then when they went and did the DVDs, when they composited back the special effects on the widescreen film, they did something to it to make it even worse.
Because it didn't match
something
up. It didn't fit
or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're never going to go back and spend the money and the time to just redo the effects and everything.
Oh, man, that would be great, like they did with Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly. I just can't see them doing. I just don't think that they think there's a demand for it.
No, it would be a very specialty item, I think.
Yeah. So. Oh, well. Well, we've still got. I mean, but part of the fun and the joy of Babylon 5 is knowing that it's kind of a low-budget thing and enjoying it for the story and the characters and not, you know, sweating so much about the effects and the sets and all that. So if you demand the highest quality special effects and sets in your shows, and you're not a fan of story and character, then stay away from Babylon 5. It's not for you. But if you love characters and drama and depth and all that, and you can look past the superficialities, then this is right up your alley, I think. So 20 years. Wow, it's hard to imagine. And
I feel so old.
But all right. Well, I guess we'll wrap things up again for this week. Look for those other episodes down the ways a little bit. Bobby, thanks so much for joining for the awards show we did earlier and now for this show.
Sure, no problem.
All right, we'll have you on again for when we get to the next if Babylon 5, unless we do something before then. So, all right, the rocket's going to get on out of here, so we'll see all you folks down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.